Okay, thanks. I appreciate the invitation to be here and present to this really good audience. So I got a little bit excited, maybe overexcited about preparing this talk. So I wanted to give something fairly big picture. So this is not a specific research paper here. I want to describe a vision that I have in mind for research in financial simulation. I'm not going to claim that it's entirely original. I'll point out some things that have happened in the past that are pointing this direction. I'm sorry if I've overlooked something that's gone on that either that you've published or perhaps haven't published, and then one good side effect of this will be that maybe afterwards people tell me about some of the things that they're doing that fit in kind of this paradigm. But at least one of the things I hope will be new for most people is I want to provide an overview of some of the resources methodologically that we can use towards achieving this kind of vision. So the outline of the talk is that I'll give you some examples of where we deal with repeating similar simulation problems again and again in financial applications and talk about different paradigms for how we would try to deploy simulation as a tool for solving those problems. Then talk about those resources for different ways of tackling those problems. Briefly give a couple of examples of my own applied research along these lines, and then talk some about the future directions that we could go with this, or that maybe people have gone a little with this and would like to tell me about. Okay, so I think kind of the most basic approach to this is to think about using a simulation model once in isolation every time you want to learn about an expectation, right? Because there's some stochastic model behind the expectation. In this case, the expectation is mu. It's a function of some parameters. So I'm going to use theta a lot to indicate parameters of a stochastic model, like volatility, and psi to indicate parameters that have to do with the securities involved, like a strike price, something like that. So all of these things feed into a stochastic model for, say, a payoff of a derivative security, and then we're looking for an expected discounted payoff, and we're running a simulation of one stochastic model to learn about one expectation, approximating it here by a sample average, and the omegas indicate random numbers that underlie paths that the market follows, something like that. So you can see here that the random numbers are indexed by the problem, so that's where we have an I and a J for the different scenarios that we're dealing with, I, the different securities we're dealing with, J, and then on top of that, H, indexing the different replications that we have within one particular run of the simulation model that we're using to approximate one expectation. And in this run-oriented paradigm of simulations, the simulation effort you can really think of in accounting terms as being like an expense, right? We spend computing effort, then we get one answer. The computing effort was used up in getting that one answer. That's it. So if I'm the CPU, then the way I think about being assigned a whole sequence of simulations like this is that, okay, this is kind of interesting. I'm simulating payoffs to learn about the price of security one. Now come back, there's a different strike price. I'm asked to do kind of the same thing for security two. This feels really, really familiar. I was just doing the same thing very recently. Now tomorrow comes along, so the theta market scenario changes, different volatility is being used here. Now it's like deja vu all over again. I had this whole sequence of problems I did yesterday. Now it's today. One of the parameters changed a little bit. I'm kind of doing the exact same thing again, just with one parameter changed. And what kind of bugs me about this is that it seems like the data we've generated through simulation is totally wasted, and we didn't even learn anything from it. Right? So we might like to learn something from having done very similar problems in the past. Or ideally, we might even be able to reuse some of the results of computation that we did in the past to speed up what we want to do right now. So the other paradigm would be to think about the entire problem, that is, set of tasks that we want to be able to solve based on stochastic models that we're going to simulate. So we think about now there's an entire simulation experiment which could include more than one run of the simulation model with different parameters, theta and psi, plugged into it. And that's supposed to support getting answers for the entire problem, which means being able to approximate any expectation that comes from this stochastic model with any set of parameters plugged into it. So in that sense, what we're doing is making a computational investment, again, in accounting terms. So there's some kind of big expenditure, but it's not used up right away just in generating one answer. It keeps being productive. It keeps paying dividends, if you will, as we come back to our model and ask it more and more questions about different expectations that all come from that model with different parameters. And the reasons for doing this would be maybe it'll overall reduce the computational cost because we're not throwing stuff out. So if we use this model often enough, eventually it may pay off to have made a big investment in computation. And the other thing is what I call simulation on demand, meaning that you could get an answer from your model right away without waiting to do a big simulation run, right? So if you made an investment in computation in advance, as soon as you thought about some combination of parameters that you'd like to know the expectation for, you'd have some sort of answer right away and you wouldn't even have to wait. So here's some more concrete examples of the repeated simulations. Sometimes we have like a fixed set of options that we want to price. So we know exactly which parameters we're interested in evaluating the function mu at, that which represents the expectation. But with the run-oriented paradigm, what we would do is take these options one at a time, for each one, simulate a bunch of paths, and look at a sample average, throw all of that out, then just start over again, right? This is the deja vu with security number two, et cetera. So now a lot of people wouldn't actually do that. You know, they face real problems like this, and they wouldn't actually do that. So this is a bit more of an example of the problem-oriented paradigm of what people would do. Simulate a whole bunch of paths which are relevant to all of these similar options, right? And then just evaluate the different payoffs with different parameters C here representing strike prices and maturities. But what I'm talking about could be pushed even further than that. We might be able to approximate the price of an option using simulation runs that involved different sets of parameters from the one that we're interested in right now. So that's the direction that I'm going to be going with this. Another example where the markets are moving every day, so there's something that we're going to, a task that we're going to do again and again and again. We don't know in advance exactly which are the parameters that we'll become interested in because we can't predict what's going to be the result of calibration a week from now. And so that's why these thetas are capitalized here to indicate that they're actually random variables, right? So again, the run-oriented paradigm is every day, forget whatever happened before, just look at what today's parameters are, run some simulations. But we could, if we look for a problem-oriented paradigm for doing this, we would say in advance, we're going to pick some scenarios for the market parameters theta that we think are interesting, do some simulations there and store the results and draw on those results later on when on day I, we find out what are the parameters for that day. And then we try to assess the relevance of the simulations that we did before and get an approximation for the expectation that we just learned this morning that we're interested in. More complicated examples, nested simulation, which comes up in portfolio risk measurement. So we have one model for what could the parameters be tomorrow, governing a stochastic model of the market. We have some idea of how they might change. And then in each one of those scenarios, we want to be able to revalue the entire portfolio. So we can have an inner level of simulation there. And this is what it is in the run-oriented paradigm. In scenario I, we take those parameters, plug them into the stochastic model, simulate, get payoffs for all of the derivative securities in the portfolio, get an estimate of the options portfolio's value under that scenario. And then at the end, in step three, now we have, if you like, an empirical distribution function coming out of the simulation for what would tomorrow's portfolio value be, and we apply some risk measure to that, whether it be variance or value at risk, et cetera. But if we take a problem-oriented approach to step number two of this procedure, we could think about first picking some small number of scenarios to look at. So capital K might be thousands of scenarios that we need to look at to assess portfolio risk, but we actually run simulations only maybe at 100, something like that, and then again use the results of those simulations to approximate the portfolio value in all of the scenarios that we wanted to have a portfolio value for. And so this has been done quite some time ago. This is just my favorite paper on that topic. There are a few others. This one by John Fry called Monte Carlo by Day, which relates to that simulation on demand idea, that during the day you can update the risk measure of your portfolio by using this computing that took place previously over the previous night, something like that. But the nasty thing about this approach is that it introduces a bias in attempting to estimate the portfolio value in scenarios where you didn't actually run a simulation. So we'll talk about that more. Another example with nested simulation, different application, American option pricing. This one is going to be familiar to a lot of people, right? So we simulate a whole bunch of paths of the underlying, and then we wish that at each step on every path, we knew what the continuation value was for continuing to hold the option instead of exercising it, because we want to use that to decide when do we think is the best time to stop and exercise. So that's the tau hat is our guess as to that policy, which then enables us to come up with an approximate price using that policy, which is hopefully close to optimal. And so something really kind of impractical, which prompted people to think about problem-oriented paradigms here, if you just tried to use the run-oriented paradigm in step number two to approximate continuation values, then at each step on every path, you need to launch some nested simulation conditional on where you are on that path right then to approximate this conditional expectation, which is the continuation value. And then you would throw out all of that work and just move on to the next step. And so a solution which gained a lot of popularity is instead to use the information generated at all time steps on all paths to approximate continuation values everywhere. Right? So that's a really great example of this problem-oriented paradigm. So regression Monte Carlo, let me spell that out in more detail. So step number zero, as it were, is you have to choose some basis functions. Right, so here my B is going to be a vector valued function, so you know 10 dimensions if you've chosen 10 basis functions. And there's kind of an art to doing this, and so having to make this choice isn't necessarily comfortable. The choice could end up having to be problem specific and rely on your knowledge and intuition of the analyst. So here's the backward recursion framework for regression Monte Carlo, which is at the end the continuation value is zero, then we step backward through time by approximating the value of the option as the maximum of exercising now or continuing, and the key is to approximate the continuation value at the previous step as this linear combination of the basis functions which you get from multiple regression. Right? So there's an example of how information from everywhere within this big simulation is being used again and again and again to approximate multiple conditional expectations. But there's a bias here, similar to what we were discussing on the last slide, and it depends a lot on the choice of basis functions, which determines how well a linear combination can possibly fit the actual continuation value. Okay, so that's the rub. But this leads us to a much more broadly applicable concept, which is essentially what's gone on here is that we had some approximation to the continuation value for each time step. That's why I've plugged in the T here. So for some particular time step, we're trying to approximate this entire function of the state variables with this other function which has a hat on it, which we'll call metamodel. So metamodeling in general, instead of taking the run-oriented approach, which is whenever I want to know some expectation, I run a simulation at that particular parameter, instead we think about, well, I want to learn about the entire function, mu. How does this expectation is a function of the parameters of the model. What does that behave like? I'm going to get k data points here from running k simulations, and then try to approximate the entire function just by looking at what I got at those data points. And that resulting approximation is called a metamodel, because it's kind of like telling you what would your simulation model say if you were able to run it everywhere in the space that you cared about, which you can't because it would take too long. And what this does is give you, once you have the metamodel, you can very, very quickly get an answer about that approximates mu of theta, but it's not as accurate as a very long simulation run would be, but it's much faster. So therefore, if you're looking for many answers, you might be able to reduce the total computational cost this way. And if you want an answer very fast, that simulation on demand, you can get that from the meta model. Possibly, depending what kind of meta model you're looking at, you could get Greeks by actually looking at the gradient of this surface. And by the way, throughout, since these slides are going to be posted online, I've given links to where you can find more about what I or other people have said about these topics if you're interested in the particular things on this slide. Okay, but there's no such thing as a free lunch, because if we're going to be making inferences about mu of theta without actually running the simulation model at theta, we'll have to make assumptions about things like what kind of smoothness properties does this function mu have, for example. Or this noise that comes from Monte Carlo simulation, in our case, how does that behave, right? So here's what our simulation output looks like. There's the mean function, and then there's this average over independent replications. So we'll talk about that later. There are a lot of meta-modeling techniques which have different assumptions, and if your assumptions don't describe this situation that you really find yourself in, then you'll just end up with a meta-model which is a bad approximation to the reality. Okay, so regression is one way, as in regression Monte Carlo, of doing meta-modeling. And so there the assumptions are that this mu function is a linear combination of the basis functions that you chose, so they have to be known. And also that those noise terms are all independent across all different parameters, theta, as well as replications, j. And if you're doing ordinary least squares, then you're also assuming that they all have the same variance, v. If you're doing weighted least squares, then you're assuming they can have different variances at sorry, that's a typo. The variances should be depending on theta. You know, they can be different in different parts of space, depending if the volatility is high today or low tomorrow, the amount of Monte Carlo noise can be different. So in this picture, we see, this is not a financial example, sorry, it's just one that I had in hand that comes from queuing, but the main point is just what happens when you're doing regression and you don't actually know perfect basis functions, which is basically all of the time. So in this case, if least squares are a criterion, then there's a curve with red dots, which is as well as we can possibly do in fitting the truth with the basis functions that we've chosen here, which in this case it's quadratic. So that's a constant and x squared. And you can see that we just don't do that well. So when we're using ordinary least squares, we're getting really close to the best that we can do in this example, but it's just not a tremendously good fit if you want to get something like really accurate derivative security prices from the meta model. And so although you might think that weighted least squares is a better approach since these Monte Carlo error variances are actually different in different regions of the space, there are perils that come with that as well. In this particular case, what happens is that this noise variance is much higher over here at the left end, and therefore, essentially, weighted least squares regression assumes that it's much less important to fit at the left end of the curve since the information there is less reliable. So you can see that qualitatively and quantitatively that produces kind of a disaster. So the best fit can be very bad, or even if you do a good job of choosing basis functions, not so great, and handling the noise in this framework seems to be posing some challenges. There are dangers both to weighted least squares and also to ordinary least squares, which is causing us to be very far away from data points that were extremely accurate, actually. So maybe non-parametric regression would be a better choice. That's my view on the topic right now. There's some important questions that we need to ask when we're doing metamodeling. And one of them is, should we make it an assumption of the metamodeling technique that the truth actually has to equal a linear combination of basis functions? And I would say no. In general, in our applications, we just don't know what the true form of mu is. If we do, that could be a powerful thing to include in your assumptions that would make you do better, but we generally don't. The other thing that we should ask is, should we be trying to filter out noise in the observations? And yes, because Monte Carlo simulation produces noise, And on top of that, if we have independence across the different simulation runs, then it's not the same noise systematically affecting everything. So we can try to filter it out. This is a classic filtering situation. But because of this inequality of the variances of the errors at different points in the space, that filtering isn't totally trivial. And in fact, we know in many cases how that variance varies across space, or rather we can estimate it pretty accurately. If we have multiple replications at each scenario, then we can measure the variance that's coming from Monte Carlo there. So the answer to those two questions leads me to look at the approach of nonparametric regression, which is kind of an umbrella. And under that umbrella, we find various things such as smoothing splines as opposed to interpolating splines, right? Because now we think we should filter out noise instead of interpolating through everything that we see. There are kernel smoothing methods, and which tend to essentially focus mostly locally around the area where we're trying to predict. That's where they gather most of the information from, and distant regions don't have a whole lot of effect. That can be different from classic linear regression. And likewise, continuing that theme of doing things locally around where we're trying to predict, there are methods like moving least squares. There are a lot of tools that we can bring to attack these problems. There are certainly challenges, different financial problems will have different challenges embedded in them. There are places where we get non-differentiability from options payoffs, right, or even discontinuities. And then, again, as problems get high-dimensional, it becomes more difficult to do a good job of metamodeling, or perhaps you might need a really large number of data points to do a good job all throughout a high-dimensional space. So one particular method that I'd like to plug, since I've been working on it and designing it for some of these particular purposes, is called stochastic kriging, because it's related to a metamodeling method called kriging, which I think it's easiest to understand really belongs to that smoothing splines family. So there is an explicit choice of basis functions that's buried in here, although I won't get into the details. But the key thing for me in the way I like to think about it is that we're kind of looking at two different types of variability here. The first is what's intrinsic to Monte Carlo simulation. And so that just has to do with simulation runs at any particular set of parameters that we're looking at. And the other has to do with the spatial variability of the function mu across the parameter space. And what this is based on is viewing that itself as being random, as being a random field, right? Because if space is one-dimensional, we could call it a random process, a stochastic process. Now the space of parameters is higher-dimensional, so we call it a random field. And in particular, in this method, it's assumed to be a Gaussian random field. And its mean has this trend, which is a linear combination of basis functions again. But the departures from that trend are considered to be important. And so if you look at the value of the function mu at two different places, theta and theta prime, there's a covariance between them, and this is not related to Monte Carlo itself. This is basically related to our uncertainty before we start the problem as to what this true function mu is shaped like. Right, so in the end, the way it works is that by looking at the data that comes from the simulation, we try to model what's a likely correlation structure for these departures from the trend, and then use that to fill back in predictions at other places where we didn't actually run simulations. So that's the smoothing splines aspect of things. Okay, so when you do that, your prediction at theta, that is, when you evaluate the metamodel at theta, you get a trend plus a weighted average of residuals at all of the design points, which are the places, the sets of parameters at which you ran simulations. Okay, and this gives us a behavior which falls somewhere in between regression and interpolation. Those are kind of the two extreme cases. Now I'd like to switch gears completely away from metamodeling to a different approach for having a problem-oriented paradigm for deploying simulation. So this is called database Monte Carlo. Now it also will store information from simulations everywhere and use that to try to improve the process of approximating the mean function at one particular point. But here are the differences. So in metamodeling, we didn't actually have to do any simulation at all at some new parameter theta in order to approximate the value of mu there. But if, with database Monte Carlo, you will have to run some simulation everywhere that you want to have an estimate. But the corresponding advantage of database Monte Carlo versus metamodeling is that the resulting estimate isn't biased. You actually did run a simulation there, and so you don't suffer the bias that comes from trying to interpolate across space, if you will, via metamodeling. And the way this is done with database Monte Carlo is by exploiting the structure of the payoff itself, right? So y of omega theta is the payoff if the random numbers are omega and theta is the parameters, right? So now we're actually explicitly going to think about how the payoff for one particular random number varies as we change the parameters. That's unlike metamodeling, where we're talking about how mu, the expectation, changes as a function of theta. So here's how it works. So you pick some parameter, theta 0, and you simulate a whole lot there. So capital N is very big, large number of replications, and you save all of the outputs in a database, right? So it's a pair. You have what random number did I plug into the simulation model, and what payoff did I get out at theta 0. And then you use this information that you've stored in the database to do variance reduction. And so you are going to do a new simulation at every point theta that you care about, but it's going to be a much smaller simulation if you can do really good variance reduction on the basis of the database that you generated. So this idea is due to Perus, Vakili, and his co-authors, and I think it has a lot of potential in finance. So here are a couple of ways that it could work. First, with control variance. You have to pair it with some variance reduction method. So here the motivation is that if the parameters are near each other, then the payoffs may be very, very highly correlated, which makes the one that you already studied in your simulation at theta naught a very good control variate for the payoff at theta, which is the new one that you're interested in. Now, the problem with that is that you generally wouldn't know, actually, the expectation of the payoff. You needed a simulation model to study it, right? But the solution is that we can still think of the payoff from the old point theta 0 as a quasi-control variate, meaning we don't actually know its mean, but we have a really good approximation to its mean. Reason, we already did an enormous simulation back at theta 0. And so that's what we see over here. This whole formula is just the classic control variance estimator, except that where we should be subtracting off the mean, instead we're subtracting off a very good approximation to the mean that we got when we were building the database at theta 0. So this is very much going to be like the control variance estimator with a little bit of extra noise that comes in from not quite knowing the mean at theta 0. Another example, database Monte Carlo with stratification as the variance reduction technique. This is a little bit different because you have to do some extra work in structuring the database. In this case, by sorting it. That's what happens here in step 2. And then once you've imposed this structure on it, that enables you to do more variance reduction things. So in this case, what we do is we take all of those random numbers that we had done in our simulation at theta 0 and stratify them, you know, contiguously. So we have little n blocks of random numbers, which, remember, they've been sorted in order of their payoff when evaluated at the parameter theta 0. And then we resample from those, say one from each stratum, and then that gives us this stratified sampling estimator of the mean at theta. So the big advantage of doing this with structured database Monte Carlo compared to just actually trying to use stratification and doing it by hand is that you never actually had to build a partition of say, the unit hypercube here. And you don't need to know the probabilities of the strata. You don't need to know how to sample conditional on being in the strata because you're actually just sampling numbers that are between 1 and n. And the reason that this accomplishes anything is because of the sorting. So the reason that it accomplishes something is if the payoff at the old point theta 0 and the payoff at the new point theta are close to being co-monotone, like perfect rank correlation, then these strata would be extremely good, right? And if this is close to true, then the strata will be quite good. Okay, so now I'd like to move on to some applications that I've worked on, creating these problem-oriented algorithms for simulation. Okay, so in this one, our goal is that we'd like to know, to have good approximations for security prices over a whole range of parameters for the market scenario, theta, and for a whole bunch of different securities indexed by J. Okay, so for each one of these securities, we're going to build a meta model for its price separately, but on the basis of common simulations at a few different scenarios, which we've chosen to fill the space of likely scenarios that we'll encounter tomorrow, right? So the idea is we should get probably accurate meta models tomorrow when we learn what the new market scenario is tomorrow. And so the procedure here is first to design a simulation experiment which will support this in step two, and then in step three to figure out if it's good enough yet, and then to refine it if it's not. So use stochastic kriging to build meta models. Use cross-validation, that is, try taking out data points and seeing how much worse you do, until you're convinced that the pricing error is small enough. Right? And if it's not small enough yet, then you'd better either add some more scenarios to fill space more fully to get better interpolation, essentially, or you'd better add more simulation effort at the existing scenarios to reduce the Monte Carlo noise. And so we propose rules in this paper for how to do that. And the result that we had from one example of 75 securities was that it only took a couple of hours on one PC to get really small average relative mean squared errors relative to the security price. So I think this is a pretty appropriate level here. This is fairly precise. And average meaning average over the market scenarios that could emerge tomorrow. Right? And so all of these meta models became quite accurate in just a couple of hours. And since it's really easy to parallelize algorithms like this, I think that means that if you have hundreds or a thousand PCs in your network, as is not uncommon these days, then you can handle really large portfolios like this. Another example, this is the portfolio risk measurement application. So we're looking at here specifically the risk measure is expected shortfall or conditional value at risk at a level P that was 5 or 1%. So we're looking off at one tail of the loss and averaging those values. That's what goes into the expectation. So here's our nested simulation recipe in general. Right. So what we want to do in step two, the key step, is have approximations in every one of the thousand, say, scenarios that are simulated. That's what's here in this picture. Right? So here are the thousand scenarios that might occur tomorrow for here a couple of different stock prices. This is what they could be tomorrow. And the ones that are stars over here, these are the ones that turn out to be the tail scenarios. In this example, the worst 10 out of all 1,000 scenarios. That's here, red represents the biggest losses, right? So these are the ones whose values will actually enter into the expected shortfall estimate that's produced at the end of the nested simulation. So here's the recipe for doing this. Again, first, you have to pick some set of scenarios at which you're going to run simulation. So this tries to fill space near the area that's likely for tomorrow's scenario to be in. So then we use stochastic kriging to figure out which of these scenarios are likeliest to be in the tail. Okay, so that's represented here by triangles are the ones that are algorithm added, and dots represent the ones that are actually in the tail, so the algorithm did a good job of figuring out which those ones were. Then in step three, add more replications to these design points, proportional somehow to how much of an influence they're likely to have on the final estimator. Right, so we see that some of these bars here are taller than others. That represents getting more simulation effort. And then the ones with the black heads are the ones that are actually tail scenarios. So you can see that those did get a lot of computation. And then some other ones that are near them got a lot of computation. And there weren't too many that were far away that got a lot of computation. Here, these ones happen to be associated with losses that are pretty large, but not quite in the tail. Right? So we ended up spending some effort on those too. And then in the end, here's the final stochastic kriging meta model, where now what red indicates is a bad fit. So that is an estimate of loss that's far from the true loss. And so what you can see is that over here, these are the regions that we care about most that have the tail scenarios in them, and that's where the meta model happens to have very high quality because of where we guided the simulation budget to be spent. And so the result of this was that the root mean squared error was 50 times better than if you just did a standard nested simulation with equal amounts of effort at every one of the 1,000 scenarios and took a run-oriented perspective and looked at each scenario in isolation. Okay, so those are a couple of applications that exist now. There's a bunch of stuff that's ongoing in some areas, and I'd like to talk about where some places that I think that these concepts could have a good payoff, and what else maybe we should be doing in the future. So nested simulation is definitely a great application for this. So the paper that you just saw with my student Ming Liu applies stochastic Krieging metamodeling here, and then there's another one by Jeff Hong and Sandeep Juneja, which involves applying kernel smoothing in a nested simulation. I think it would be a great idea to apply database Monte Carlo, but I don't know about that having been done yet. And there are all sorts of interesting things to be done here, tailored to the particular application that you have. So it's not just throw metamodeling at it and walk away, but some of the adaptive allocation ideas, like I just discussed, where do we put the simulation effort? I had that on the last slide, and you can see that in some other papers by Mark and CMAC, for example, or by Michael Gordy and Sandeep Juneja. And what got me most excited about this is with Mark and CMAC, the idea that perhaps in nested simulation, by using some of these ideas, we can get closer to the 1 over the computational budget rate of convergence that we hope to get from Monte Carlo, whereas in a lot of nested simulation applications that we've seen so far, the rate of convergence is significantly worse than that, to the point where people think of nested simulation as being either impractical or the method of last resort. And in American Options, I think we can do some good things here. In fact, they've been done to some extent already, like Stathis and one of his students were working on applying ideas maybe better than just ordinary least squares regression in regression Monte Carlo, including some non-parametric regression ideas to see if that would work better. And one of the payoffs here would be that maybe then if we had a good generic methodology, we wouldn't have to worry so much about figuring out what are the right basis functions and testing how well we perform that way. And I think it's interesting to think also in American Options about the particular objective that we have here, which is yes, no, stop or continue, as opposed to what I presented generally, where the output of the metamodel is a real number. In this case, we don't necessarily care about that. The crucial thing is the yes, no decision. And in general, whenever we want to apply these things, I think it's interesting to think about how do you design a really efficient algorithm applying metamodeling or database Monte Carlo to get efficient computation, to validate whether the metamodel that you produced is actually giving you accurate answers or not. And I had this paradigm that was talking about where you make an investment in computation, then it pays dividends later on. But what happens when you want to add more simulation effort later on? How then are you going to update metamodels, for example? I think that's interesting to think about in the context of particular applications. As for the methodology of doing metamodeling in database Monte Carlo, one of the things I'm thinking about is under what circumstances should you be using each of these non-parametric regression techniques? You know, given what aspects of your problem do you decide what technique to deploy? If we were going to estimate the variance of the Monte Carlo error at each one of the parameter values that we're looking at, how do we utilize that information in filtering or smoothing? And is it always necessarily a good idea to do that? Or is it sometimes better just to have one replication, for example, at each one of your simulation runs and not be estimating the variance like this? And then, as we said, metamodeling produces bias. And I think analyzing that in the context of Monte Carlo simulation is important, and then doing something to reduce it would certainly be very helpful. And one of the biggest challenges is definitely the experiment design. If we're not going to do a simulation run at every one of the parameter values that we care about, well, where are we going to do them? That's placing the design points. How much effort does each one of these get? How do you make that decision? I think there's some interesting theoretical things about how low do we need to reduce the Monte Carlo variance at each one of these points for purposes of kind of managing the noise to signal ratio as we're trying to do this filtering. So of course, there's a whole lot known about these questions in statistics, but I don't know yet exactly what's the best way of applying that in the simulation context, where some of the distinctive things are. It's very easy to create adaptive algorithms which make decisions as we're in the midst of making this computational investment about where we should be spending our budget. And we do tend to have very large numbers of replications which opens some doors. And then for experiment design with database Monte Carlo, as far as I know, that's actually a totally open topic where we simply don't know anything yet about where do you want to build databases and how big should they be, et cetera. And another thing which is open is combining metamodeling and database Monte Carlo, because each one of them has advantages, and I think it would be very interesting to see if there's some synergy that comes from trying to use them together. Okay, so to sum up in somewhat grandiose terms, what I would kind of wish to see is whenever we introduce a model that we're going to use again and again, we think about what range of parameters we expect to use it over. And then, maybe to focus on metamodeling instead of database Monte Carlo, then we build a metamodel and validate it so that it's good over that entire domain when we introduce the model. And then, when it comes time to use the model, first we check, are the current parameters within the domain that we can already guarantee good performance for? If not, then maybe we'd better expand that domain and make some greater computational investment. But if we are in the domain where we think we know what we're doing, and we don't need extremely high fidelity, then we just use the metamodel. And if we're actually going to trade on these prices or something like that and we need really high fidelity, then we may run some more simulations right here, check that we're actually doing really well at this particular point, and then having made that extra investment, update the metamodel again, because we don't want to waste the effort that we just did. So the real point here is that in variance reduction, we often talk about kind of how are we going to reduce the amount of computing we need to do to get a good answer. Here I'm talking about how do we reuse the computing that we've done to continue to get answers in the future very efficiently, right? So the idea is every time we run simulation for a model, we should be storing the output of that in some form, maybe condensed, right, because we don't want to fill terabytes of space or anything. And the metamodel or the database in DBMC give us ways of storing that information that we generated in a form that's going to pay dividends later on, so that we would never actually discard the output of simulations until we were done using the model and we knew we were never going to ask another question of it again. So that's the vision. Thanks for your attention. And maybe I've used up all of my time, so I don't have to take any questions and I can run away. Ah, bad plan.